Mini episode 1906 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge Mini Episode 1906. You have with you here today FDH Lounge dignitaries Rick Morris and Derek Allen. We were here last week previewing Super Bowl 60. We are back today to review what went down. And as two guys who looked at it, really kind of did their homework, went through, picked Seattle to win relatively convincingly in the case of both of us. Nothing happened that was really necessarily a surprise for either one of us, as I'm going to get into. Maybe a surprise out there to folks who were wearing rose-colored glasses for whatever reason. Didn't want to just accept the fact that we were going to be in for a subpar Super Bowl when this matchup came about. But again, credit to us, Derek. Nothing that happened there as far as the outcome of the game, the shape of the game, whatever. Really, nothing was a surprise to us, or I think should have been a surprise to anybody that was paying attention the whole time.
No, absolutely. I mean, if the only thing I was really shocked by was just how inept the Patriots offense ended up being. I didn't expect that. I thought, you know, they'd be able to move the ball some and then get stopped. And that, like, I didn't think it would be just their offensive line would just be like made of paper, and their start and their, you know, first round draft pick in Campbell is just like a revolving door. That was the shock to me. I'm going to credit the Seahawks more. I mean, we've seen in some of the post articles that have come out that McDonald had spotted. I forget what it was. He was noticing the offensive line was giving away pitches in film, just stuff like that. So, I mean, you have to give it to them. But, I mean, the shock to me was just – and I know we said it'd be a defensive game, but to me, I didn't think in my head at the time that that meant the Patriots would just be inept out there.
Well, and it is – it's legitimately one of the worst offensive performances I've ever seen. And I discount the fourth quarter. That was pretty much garbage time at that point. Once it got to be 19 to nothing, it was all over. And it was reminiscent up until that point in time of another NFC West team, except they were the team that was executing in that form and fashion, the 2018 LA Rams. Once they didn't have Todd Gurley anymore, he was a legitimate big part of that offense that year. But once he got hurt, once he wasn't the same, that's how they looked against, ironically, the New England defense. This time it was the New England offense looking like that. I will say about Will Campbell, it is just an extension of how he played all throughout the playoffs. And he did not have really an excellent regular season either. Now, it comes out afterwards, he said he was playing through a bad knee injury. And okay, we'll see. I don't know that he's necessarily going to be any better next year. I mean, he might be if everything that he's ascribing to the injury proves to be the case. There were some questions, I think, about his wingspan a bit, you know, if he had long enough arms to play tackle. We'll see. They may want to move him back inside to guard. Mike Vrabel was sounding very defiant about that after the game. He's our left tackle. We're staying with him. We'll see how that plays out. But Drake May, as rattled as he looked in the playoffs, again, that was part of it too, what I was looking at here. And again, what just puzzles me about some of what I was hearing before the game from some people that were really, really desperate, it seems like, just to be like, oh, really? You think you know what's going to happen? Like, sometimes the conventional wisdom's right. And I'm not afraid to go with the conventional wisdom when I think it's right. But there was a lot of people that were like, oh, really? Oh, really? Like, what made you think, looking at Drake May and that offensive line through the AFC playoffs, that things were going to get miraculously better playing against Seattle, which, again, to me, it's a toss-up between Seattle and Houston, who's the best defense in the league. After this game, maybe we say definitively that it was Seattle. But, again, I just, there was nothing that I was seeing that, like, I'm like you. I didn't think it was going to be, again, worst offensive performance ever through three quarters. And basically that's about how long the game really went, non-garbage time. Did I think it was going to be just in the running for worst offensive performance in a Super Bowl? I did not. But I didn't expect anything good from New England, put it that way.
Yeah. I mean, to go back, the people that, you know, had their rose-colored glasses, it was just, honestly, it's the people that see Patriots Super Bowl and then their brain just flips back to Brady. And I mean, shoot, even, you know, I know you said when it was 19-0, it was over. I don't think I truly said it was over until, what was it? Wasn't it like 19-7? They were driving and then May had that really bad pick.
Mm-hmm.
That's yes. When I was like, it was over.
Yeah, there was the pick six, because again, it was 22-7. That made it 29.
The pick six was later, I think.
Oh, it might have been.
Am I wrong? It was, I thought it was, they score, it was 19-0. Patriots score, they get a stop, they get the ball back, and then they were driving, and then Drake May had horrible throw. I don't know, it was into like triple coverage.
Yeah.
Might be misremembering, but that was the other thing too, is like, May just didn't, like, I don't know if it was, you know, the scale of the moment or if just Seattle defense, maybe it was a combo of both, but he was making some throws that were just, especially at the end there when they weren't even quite in garbage time yet. It was getting to sort of desperation hour, but then sure. He just started just launching it into triple coverage when there were still, I think it was like the top of the fourth quarter, like dude, you don't need to do that. So it was just that part of it was just wild. But I mean, it makes sense to go off, obviously, like the reason we made the predictions we did is when you realize New England has had the worst strength of schedule, then they get to the playoffs, they play a Houston team that has no offense to speak of, they play a Jared Stidham led Denver. Like, yeah, no, they walked their way into the Super Bowl, and shocker, the best team on the other side just made them look like people that were just gifted the opportunity to be in the Super Bowl.
Well, yeah, and it's one of those things where, and some of the whole kind of hipsterism that I was hearing is like, well, Seattle, well, they had better style points in the NFC. Style points is another term for eye test, which a lot of times is accurate. Now, I will say, great professional gambler Kyle Ross has been on this show many times over the years, and he is somebody where, again, he'll kind of scoff whenever I bring up the term eye test or anything like that, because as somebody that's a professional handicapper, they kind of scoff at those things. But a lot of times it's accurate. A lot of times what you're seeing is pretty much indicative of what you're going to get. And that's how it played out here. If you were watching Seattle through the playoffs, if you were watching New England through the playoffs, nothing that you saw in a Super Bowl should have been any kind of a shock. And as far as any of my friends, I was surprised that a couple of my friends were joining this whole New England kind of backlash to the backlash, or whatever the hell you want to call it. Were any of those friends doing this on anybody's podcast? I'll never tell. But some of them were just saying things that I couldn't just believe I was hearing. And I even heard it on Fox Sports Radio last weekend. Sometimes if I'm in my car, I enjoy listening to some of their weekend shows. I don't listen to a lot of national radio in any genre, but Fox Sports Radio is something that I've always enjoyed in bits and pieces here. And one of the hosts on there was just, he was going on this whole kind of a thing and like, well, actually, New England, if you look at it, they've had some of the best success out there at shutting down. I think he was talking about going to, or that they could exploit, I guess, like Seattle. I guess that Seattle was had a thing with like running backs and tight ends. And the guy's co-host was like, he was not wanting to cut his legs out from under him, but he's like, you realize that happens because Seattle takes away everything else, right? You're talking about dump offs. Like, you're trying to cite that as something that they can exploit. And that's what it came down to. Now, Seattle was doing a lot in the way of dump-offs during the game here. That's one of the reasons that Kenneth Walker was the deserved MVP of the game. And it was a thing where, I will say, that Darnold was making a lot of throws during the course of the game that I thought were really gutsy. Like, he was throwing into tight windows a lot. Like, this is not a guy that came into the game like, oh, well, I better not risk anything lest people circle back to the whole bust rap that was put on me. He played a gutsy game. He just wasn't connecting on a lot of these throws.
Yeah, and some of those overthrows were not great, and that kind of really opened it up quick. I think it was like that there were two – like times in the first half where JSN was like, either it was blown coverage or he had Gonzalez beat one. It was rare. Yeah. Gonzalez played lights out.
Yes.
And obviously to go to your point too, once JSN got hurt, that's when they even went fully to the run, just because at that point, if JSN's not getting separation from Gonzalez, I don't think, you know, whoever he was jumping to, I'm assuming Cup after that was going to, but yeah, it was, Darnold, I think, obviously, I agree with you. He played a little gutsy, but he also he didn't really, some of those throws that could have really made it the game end a lot sooner, he kind of missed. But
yeah,
I mean, at the end, I guess where I'm going with that is, do you think that was gutsy, or do you think he was being careful of like, I'm gonna put a little more air on this. I don't know.
It might be in terms of like, if you miss in a spot where at least it's not going to be an interception down the field, that is a possibility. Now, again, and I was talking with FDH Lounge dignitary John Adams about this, that like Christian Gonzalez in the game that he played, I mean, he played a very good game. But as far as a lot of the breakups that he had during the game, I mean, I'm sitting there, and again, I got my anti-Boston goggles on, as I do in any sport. And there's a lot of them where I was like, where's the flag? Where's the flag? Now, I'm not saying I'm a reliable narrator on that. I may not be.
But I like that there were no flags.
But, I mean, there were some. Look, I will freely admit it was my frustration bleeding through that some of those weren't completions. So some of my where's the flag may have been emotionally based, may have been. But regardless, if they're not calling it, you know, again, or whatever, however you want to phrase it, if it's the old Bobby Heenan, you ain't cheating, you ain't trying, then who knows? But Gonzalez played a brilliant game under the circumstances, was one of the only things that was keeping New England in this thing to any degree. And it was a classic kind of a thing here. Again, I beat this drum a lot on the show. For a game that was 9-0 at halftime, 12-0 in the third quarter, like, not every close game is an exciting game. Some close games suck. I realize that I'm going against the grain on that, that there's a lot of people who are like, any close game is inherently thrilling. Not if it's a slop fest. And offensively, it was a complete slop fest for New England through three quarters.
Yeah.
And a partial slop fest.
I didn't think Seattle was a slop fest. There was just
not slop,
but they were going through some mud.
Well, slop fest versus perfectly cromulent does not equal world's most thrilling game. You know what I mean?
I agree.
Like,
yeah,
that's it. Not every game that's close is exciting. And it was a close game most of the way. I even said to the fellas at the Super Bowl party here that, like, something that, and I think they kind of agree with me on this, that one of the most overrated Super Bowls of all time was Rams Titans, because everybody remembers how it ended with like the lunge for the goal line, whatever. Like, it was 9-0 at halftime in that one, and like, we're falling asleep, and it's like, this sucks. And then the second half, it kind of picked up and it got more exciting. But the people that put that one on the short list of greatest Super Bowls ever, I don't know what they're smoking. Because there's something about Super Bowls that are 9-0 at halftime that, like, they just, this one was worse than that one. It didn't even end exciting. But it went in a way where, again, it was, you know, look, I said 27-13. It turned out to be 29-13. I mean, I was wrong about some of the things stylistically here and there, but I wasn't wrong about Seattle's going to win the game convincingly. I will say, in looking at the box score, like, one of the funniest things to me that I saw is that third down conversion rate. New England was actually 6-15, Seattle 4-16. Like, you know, I'm really doing the Mandela effect when I look at that box score.
Yeah.
Like, I don't remember that being the case. Like, you know what it is, though? I don't think Seattle, on any of the drives where they're doing anything, I think it was never even getting the third down, right?
No, yeah. I think a lot of it was Walker, good first down. And then, you know, they would do like a check down or something small or run Walker again. Like, it was, I mean, Walker was a beast. I mean, and the other thing I was thinking too is how much worse that game would have been in terms of like how like that run game would have been even better if they had Charbonnet as well. And they had been subbing him in and out, throwing him in receiving packages. Cause you saw, obviously, Walker isn't the best receiver. He had a couple, he had a couple drops in the flat, which those are when they would have Charbonnet and like, yeah. So it was, again, just the fact that you, they lose JSN at halftime, they don't have Charbonnet, and they still do what they did against that New England team. I mean, like, you, New England, it's, I mean, I found myself saying, I wish we could have just had the Bills here. The Bills, it would have been so much more. I don't care how good, I mean, seeing if Josh Allen could have ran his way through that defense, that would have been so much more fun than what we got.
Yeah. It just, and that's the whole thing too, is that I think that like a lot of the stuff that I was seeing, and particularly some of the media coverage of the game coming in, when everyone, when not everyone, but some people were doing the actually about New England. And it's like, it's the human condition to where we can't accept that something's going to suck. Like, there's going to be a Super Bowl, but it's not going to be great. What? Oh, that can't be the case. Oh, like, that's what it kind of, and honestly, this reminds me of in the first segments I was doing for the year, doing the divisional previews with Chris Galloway back in August. And when we got to the AFC North, I was talking about the Browns, and I said, I just heard one of the worst, most anti-intellectual takes in the local media here. And it was from somebody that was saying, you know, something like, I refuse to accept that this season is doomed. And I remember saying at the time, and Chris agreed with me on this, that like, and I've since refined this theory. Maybe there's twice as long a period of time if you have a new coaching staff and they're implementing new systems. But you have like 10 to 15 days through the entire offseason to shape the next season. Free agency in the beginning of it, because the first 72 to 96 hours is all that really matters. The draft days, maybe the days that you spend preparing for those days. But how many days are those on the calendar? No more than 20, and probably not even 20 if you don't have a new coach in there. So you have to have made those days count. Now, Seattle, look, they did what they did a lot under the radar in the offseason with some of the acquisitions that they made, leaning on the young players to the extent that they did. Nick Amonwari, who I cited before the game as the glue guy for this defense, is just a rookie. I mean, like, we had reason to think he was going to be a special player in this defense, but this much, this soon? So, yes, there are teams like Seattle that surprise you. But do you think the Browns were going to be a team like that coming off what they were the previous season? Like, who in August was saying that? Somebody who was pandering to the knuckle draggers would say something like that. I refuse to accept that this is going to be a lost season.
Crazy because it's forgetting how much coaching matters, and you see it in like, obviously, and that's what I'm assuming you were getting to with Seattle is that McDonald was just what he did with that team. And with, I mean, it's the same kind of when Shanahan went to the Niners, when McVay went to the Rams, I mean, it's hopefully maybe we're going to have that in Arizona with LaFleur, but regardless of that, like, it's just some of these younger guys, like if they're able to mix sort of their, like, the X's and O's stuff they have along with, you know, just some of the team building piece. I mean, Michael McDonald didn't seem like he was, you know, like a Ben Johnson as much, you know, where he was like truly not only an X's and O's guys, but also, you know, a big icon in terms of like a big presence, but he must have had some way with it. Like, that turnaround was just crazy.
He's a little more low key than some, but he's very effective. And I think that it's a thing where, again, he comes across, I think, as being, you know, very, very, very legitimate. He doesn't put on airs. I think players feel like they can take him at face value. And I think there's basically two prongs to what I was saying about the Browns in August with what we've seen here. One is, again, that, like you said, coaching comes into it a lot. They had Mike McDonald, the Browns had Kevin Stefanski. But like, if you were going to put money on one of those two teams to have been the team to come out of nowhere this past year, I think we all would have said Seattle, looking at what they had in place. And that, again, it's also a thing where, again, to sit there in August after your team has had a very underwhelming offseason and to just say, I refuse to accept that this season is going to be a waste. I put that on the same level as people that like coming into a Super Bowl. It's the Super Bowl. How can it be a bad game? I refuse to accept that. Like, do we forget that two teams that a year ago on paper should have put up a classic, the Chiefs and the Eagles, that one ended up being a blowout? There are much better matchups that were bad games than what we saw here. And again, the other thing too, and this honk on Fox Sports Radio, I'm not naming him because I'm not trying to, you know, start any feuds or anything like that. So I'm not going to name who the guy was. But another thing that he said was, and I want you to tell me what you think about this.
Okay.
Like, this is a guy who's a big gambling guy, and he was like, 4.5 points, that's a lot. I'm like, 4.5 points is a lot? Has this guy forgotten things like the 49ers Chargers Super Bowl or whatever? Like, I've seen much bigger lines than 4.5 in my lifetime. Like, what do you think? Because you're more into the gambling scene than I am. Like, that sounds like hipsterism to say that like 4.5 points in a Super Bowl is automatically a lot. I don't understand that.
I don't think it in just general it's a lot. I thought it was tight. For me personally, because again, okay, remember my guess going in was 2017 Seattle.
Okay.
So in that sense, Patriots would have covered. But I mean, I said from the get, like I did not expect the Patriots offense to be worthless the way they were. So in mm-hmm. that sense, I would have said that, I think most people went in obviously either thinking the Patriots going to win or was going to be close. Obviously, I thought Seattle would control it the whole time, but I thought, you know, it'd be within a score. So in that mm-hmm. sense, yeah, I'd say 4.5, considering those two teams, what we thought of them going in. Maybe it's not a lot, but a little bit. I don't know.
Yeah, it's
weird
just,
answer.
I was curious for your perspective on this because it hit me of like saying 4.5 sounds like a lot. It just seemed like hipsterism to me because like we've had much bigger spreads in past Super Bowls. Now those were again 49ers Chargers. That's the one that kind of springs to mind. Like everybody knew in advance that game was going to be a complete whitewash. And if you go back a little further, 49ers, Broncos, certainly as well. So, I mean, this is not one where I think the average person was saying huge whitewash just because, again, when a team is a defensive powerhouse like Seattle, they're a defensive powerhouse with a good offense attached to it. Those are not the kind of games where you tend to think, oh, it's going to be 49-3. But nevertheless, yeah, I mean, like we've seen bigger spreads in the past and we've seen those bigger spreads be justified. So
I wonder what the line was for that Seattle Denver Super Bowl.
That's it. Well, you know, the nice thing is that we live in a day and age where we don't have to speculate. Yeah, exactly. So I'm Googling, you know, the odds on this here and that is, well, when you do that, it gets to odds for there to be a, oh, here we go. February 2nd, 2014. And that is, less than a field goal. By the way, this is another thing this past week. I was revisiting a bit of audio on the show this past week because I was thinking about that Seattle-Denver Super Bowl. Because this whole thing of like, people missing the forest for the trees. And I'm going to say this in as I bring this up, this is going to sound like a criticism, but let's call it a friendly jibe at somebody that I have an awful lot of respect for, a multiple time guest on the show. And one of the most prominent pro wrestlers of the 1980s and 90s, Lex Luger. So he having a football background, I remember. So he was on to talk about that Super Bowl before it happened. He was sounding like right down the line in lockstep with me on thinking that the Seattle defense was really going to be, you know, predominant in this game. And then we get to sort of towards the end, and I'm thinking that he's going to agree with me on the pick. And it was just like, I can't go against Peyton Manning. And I'm like, wait a minute. You've just outlined the case for the other side through the whole show here. So it's like, this is part of, and Lex is a very, very, very smart guy.
I probably would have made the same pick. I mean, if I look back, I probably would have said the same thing, considering that like that year of what that Denver offense did. Like,
okay. You know, and I get that to some degree, but it was a thing where it's like you spend an entire segment sort of making a case the one way, and then you kind of flinch at the logical conclusion at the end. I remember I was just like, oh, okay. Yeah, and I played it back, and I was listening to it the other day, and I was kind of chuckling. And I'm like, I love Lex. This is all in good fun. But it's like sometimes that happens, right? Sometimes we can't get ourselves to pull the trigger on what we think the conclusion is going to be. I try to police myself on that to go with what I think the logical conclusion is after I've made a case for something here. And that's what I did with Seattle. But I will say this in terms of looking ahead, because this is something that you and I had talked about here of that. And again, some of this is, and some of the criticism of New England after the game and the way that May played and whatever. And I've heard some of these honks and even like some pro New England people, like, criticizing May for some of his decision making and stuff. And like, okay, there's some of that, but it's like, to me, he is what he is. He is somewhere in between the regular season MVP candidate who played against basically ITT Tech for 17 weeks and the guy who was a dumpster fire in the playoffs in the Super Bowl. He's somewhere in between. He's a very gifted second year quarterback. And New England looked like what they were going to look like against Seattle. I guess I'm just a believer in fate on this thing. Like I remember the Seattle-Denver Super Bowl, to circle back to that, I remember saying at the time that, like, again, when you talk about the multiverse, if Seattle and Denver played 100 times, Seattle probably beats the crap out of them that badly, maybe twice. You know, that's just that first, you know, hike over the head to Peyton Manning, and like it was done. Like that, there was no coming back. It was a landslide immediately. That if you play that game 98 out of 100 times, it's probably significantly closer than that. That game, I think, was an outlier. This game that we just saw was anything but an outlier. This is like the exact thing. Again, some nuances, some things surprised me, some things surprised you. Nobody's ever 100% on what they expect and what they get. But I mean, as far as Seattle is going to win this game solidly and the New England offense is not going to look good, you know, that's a thing where, again, I think this ties to something that you said before the Super Bowl that I was certainly in agreement with, which is like, God help us all if New England wins this, because it's like, here goes the next dynasty, whatever. But like the entire point of what just happened with New England is that they're not there yet. Again, they had that, you know, toilet paper soft schedule, made it through, you know, the playoffs. And again, drew favorable matchups through the AFC. They're not there yet. I think they can get there. The odds of, I think, New England being back in the next couple of years, I actually think are pretty good because they've done a good job. I've talked about this the last two off seasons of what a good job they've done quietly with the roster building. Yeah. I think they're going to stay on that. They're going to keep patching holes, and I think they'll be back, and I think they'll be a legitimate team next time, unlike this time. I think the next time they're there, they'll be legit, and you and I will be sweating about having to watch Boston sports fans celebrating, even if we didn't have to worry about that much this time. Versus Seattle, I'm looking at this like this is a team that is built to take another one or maybe two in the next couple of years, I think.
It's all going to be on the ownership. How much do they want to spend?
That's true.
Do they want to keep Shea?
Who's it going to be?
Walker? Do they want to keep? Do they want to keep Bryant? Do they want to keep, like, either? I mean, and maybe that the team's about to go up for sale. Maybe that helps. I don't know how that whole all that works on the financial side of the NFL. But yeah, I mean, Seattle is poised to become a dynasty in itself. But yeah, they have to. They're going to need to make some choices and shell out some money.
Well, yeah. And you raise an interesting point. Like, who's going to be owning the team moving forward here? I was half expecting Goodell during the post game thing here to wave up Jim Dickens from Letterkenny to the podium to conduct, an auction right then and there for as much as they're really pressuring the Seattle ownership, the trust. The
Saudis. Here.
Yeah, could be. Dark money, baby. Dark money. But that's I keep talking about this, the Paul Allen Trust, by which we actually mean Paul Allen trusted that his family would have sold the team by this point in time. But that has not been something that has happened. So, yes, that's the biggest X factor in all of this, is if they continue to have committed ownership. But, like, who's going to want to shell out that astronomical price to buy the team only to try to run it on the cheap? I think that the most logical scenario is that they're going to continue to be run the way that they have been run. And like, again, the youth on this defense, so many of those guys on rookie contracts. I go back to it again, Nick Amonwari, who that's a guy, we do this annual ranking of the top 32 players in the NFL every year. And I fully expect him to end up making the cut as a rookie. That's how important I think he was on this defense. I mean, he probably makes the cut. I know Witherspoon does. Rookie contracts in both cases, although Witherspoon not for too much longer. But you look at the guys that they have locked in, and you look at it, and it's like, okay, they could still stand to upgrade the interior of their offensive line and maybe one or two other spots here. Could probably still use another wide receiver. You think John Schneider isn't going to be doubling down in the draft to take care of those things that I just mentioned? Like, yeah. There's a scenario where they're better next year.
If a lot of these guys go, okay, like I want to run it back. I'll take a more team friendly deal, you know, ultimately, which ended the first or the last Seattle dynasty was them losing that. Obviously that dumb Super Bowl to the Patriots killed that. Cause they were, everyone's like, I'm gonna go get my bag. I'm leaving. And don't blame anybody. Like after that, I would do the same thing, but that's going to be, I think, that's the other side of this too, that besides just, are they going to be new ownership or whatever, are they going to be willing to spend the money? The other part is going to be ultimately like, are some of these guys going to be willing to take, you know, team friendly contracts? And I think a good chunk of them will.
Yeah. And like, you know, somebody like Witherspoon, for example, I mean, yeah. You can look at it on paper and like, okay, they just go draft another CB1, but like, how do you know that that CB1 that you draft is going to be as good as this guy? And also, you're going to have to trade up an awful lot to be able to get there because Seattle sure as hell looks like they're going to be picking low the next several years. So they're not going to have the opportunity to get somebody like him in the draft. So, yeah. So, I mean, they're going to have to catch some breaks along the way, get players to do that. But, I mean, this looks like a team that wants to stay together. And, again, Mike McDonald, this is a guy where I said coming into this year, like, I didn't see it. I thought they still had – I thought they had more roster holes, believe it or not, including on defense – than they ended up having. But a lot of these signings and trades that they ended up making, that's how great this coaching staff is, to have gotten the best version out of all of these guys, along with the superlative drafting that they did, Dexter Lawrence having a real comeback in his career. And
I bringing remember Shahid in at the deadline.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said at the beginning of the year, like I didn't like their roster, but I still thought they'd win 7 games. And that was like 100%. I was like, that's because Mike McDonald's there. Like if I was looking at another, you know, like I could be saying 4 wins or something like that, looking at the remaining holes that they had. And again, I rarely get fooled to that degree when I look at a team and they don't have nearly the degree of holes that I think they're going to have. Seattle really, to their credit, fooled me and fooled a lot of people by being and ready to do it this quickly. Again, such a young defense. Such a very, very young defense with a lot of their key players. And it's like, you look at the growth curve of players and it's just like, if there's a Seattle team that's better next year, I don't think that should be a shock. I mean, they're going to go into the playoffs, which I think we all assume they're going to make at this point. Probably going to have Charbonnet back in there, right? Unless he has another fluke injury, he'll be healed by then. He'll be ready to go. So all these things here along the way, you give Schneider a chance in the draft to plug a few more of the holes that they have. Like New England, I think it's a thing of like the more in the medium term that they could become a legitimate power. I think we've seen that in the short term, they're not that close, particularly when, again, some of the other teams from the AFC come back from taking a gap year this year. This was a year where a lot of the teams you expected to make noise in the AFC didn't. That won't be the case again next year. New England with a tougher schedule. Short term, I don't like their odds. Medium term, I like their odds. But Seattle, short and medium term, I love their odds. Like this looks like a team where this looks like everything that you would want as a fan in terms of a team that's set up to win now, but could still be sustainable down the road.
When you brought up the AFC, you're still talking about the Seahawks, right?
Seahawks. Okay. Yeah. I think
100%. I do think obviously one caveat is, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious. Like the NFC is the tougher conference and Seattle is also in the tougher division.
Yes.
That's the other piece to throw in it of like, hey, Seattle, yes, they could be just as good, but they still gonna have to play LA twice. They got to play San Francisco twice. Yeah, they'll get their two free wins against us in Arizona because it'll continue to be a dumpster fire. And then we'll see, you know, what other what division they get paired with, you know, for the rest of the games. But yeah, it's. But I mean, I'm not saying I disagree at all. I'm just saying I think it's still like they can't be any injuries. We'll see how the roster looks. We'll make sure, you know, nobody has any sort of sophomore slump or anything, and or the Super Bowl hangover. Like you and probably a lot of people are tempted to do that very early future on Seattle to win the Super Bowl. I don't know.
Well,
back-to-back's tough outside of, you know, obviously what the Chiefs did that little chunk of that chunk run they had there.
And I was pretty consistently picking the Rams to win it all from midseason on. Yeah. So, but I will say this, in looking at some of the early ESPN staff picks for next year, and there were a lot of them in there where I was like, what are we doing here? Like I'm trying to remember, the one lunkhead former GM. Oh, Tannehill, I think. Tannenbaum picked like Washington over Buffalo. Like what are we doing here? But in looking at some of the ones in there, somebody actually had the same early instinct for next year than I did, which would be the craziest thing that you could imagine for a Super Bowl that's going to be at SoFi. You could make a very, very legitimate chance or a case for when you look at teams that, in the case of the Rams, only need like maybe a little bit of an upgrade in the secondary and have things go well otherwise, and the Chargers that are getting back both of their bookend offensive tackles and are going to have another offseason to augment. Chargers versus Rams in L.A. on Valentine's Day next year for the Super Bowl, the City of Angels. Stranger things have happened than that. I'm going to say it right now.
Two home teams. That would be unwatchable. No, I'm kidding. I think Herbert is not and will never be the guy. I think he's been like of the group of like Lamar, Burrow, Mahomes, Allen. I've never understood why Herbert's been thrown in there. He's done. I think he has as many playoff wins as Kyler Murray does.
Like, yeah.
Trevor Lawrence. Sure. Like I'll throw him in there. This season and some of his earlier seasons, especially after he had that, the fact that he is still playing at a high level after his rookie year being with Urban Meyer and that, you know, trash of dumpster fire of a season. Like, but no, I as cool of a storyline, I guess the two home team piece would be with LA and LA. It's not the one I see on there. And I mean, maybe Rams get through Seattle, but I mean, I honestly don't know how much Stafford's got left in the tank is my honest thought with the Rams. You saw he got a couple more injuries this year, you know, especially towards the end there. I know he's known for his toughness. He's a tough guy. I don't know how much. I think his game will quit on him before he quits on the game. And we could see that next year if he starts slipping up at all. I know he just had the MVP season, but I mean, think about the difference of Peyton from that 2014 Super Bowl year to that 2015 year where he basically just stood there and threw like in that one against Carolina. Like, I could see the LA kind of being, I could see Stafford kind of being like that. And I don't know what their backup plan after that, if that
happens. That's a good point, because I always say Peyton Manning won the first Super Bowl as Peyton Manning and he won the second Super Bowl as Trent Dilfer, because, you know, he completely got carried through that second one there. But it's a thing where, like, for any of the TV folks that might be tempted to play it cute of like, oh, man on the scene interviews, like we're going to interview 100 people on the streets of L.A. and see who their favorite team is, like 50 of the 100 are going to say the Rams and the other 50 are going to say football. I go to the beach on Sundays. What are you talking about? So like nobody's going to say Chargers, right? Like that's the one thing they gave up when they left San Diego is that, you know, they're the second class citizens in their own building, which would be, you know, but again, I could see somebody as shameless as Harbaugh playing that for all the no respect, you know, cred that he can get during Super Bowl week. So yeah, so we'll see. But that's an early kind of instinct that I have for next year if it ends up not being Seattle. But I think Philly is going to be back in the mix next year. I think Detroit's going to be back in the mix. Chicago probably, but I think they were also partially a product of their schedule. Green Bay was my preseason pick to win the Super Bowl. I think I may be potentially vindicated on that a year late. So yeah, there are a number of teams in there. And I will say too, that a team that I've ragged on vociferously the last couple of years for being stars and scrubs, that in looking at their roster, like, this is going to shock some people to hear this come out of my mouth, but you know who's done a quietly solid job of roster building the last couple of years and eliminating holes? I can't even believe I'm saying this, is the Dallas Cowboys. So I don't necessarily expect them to be in the mix, but they will have an explosive offense. I think they're bringing Pickens back. So you're right. Seattle has a lot more in its path than New England does. But even having a diminished, you know, array of teams in their path, I still don't see New England coming close to doing this again next year, just because, again, they were sort of playing ahead of where they're at on the growth curve. They caught every break this year. It happened early. And again, it's one of these things where, again, as a Vol fan, I will say, in looking at this, like, that 1998 Vol team that won the national championship, it's like, oh boy, oh, this was a year ahead of schedule. I can't wait to see what happens next year. So, you know, sometimes you do it ahead of schedule, or you get to a certain point and you don't make it back there. I think New England can and probably will a couple of years from now. I just think Seattle in the short term, even with all those heavyweights in their path, is more likely to make it back in the next year or two. But that's going to be the fun of seeing how it all shakes out, Derek.
Yeah, no, and the one thing I'll add to is my favorite early season thing to do is picking the turnaround team, who's going to come out like it. And I'm not saying, you know, like a Dallas, or I'm saying these teams that were bottom 10, and you can't, the Chiefs don't count. These teams that were bottom 10, who is, you know, which team is going to make the most noise, make the biggest jump. My going forward, I was higher on them than I probably should have been going in. But I think it's the Raiders. I think that roster is better than their record is. I think bringing in Kubiak's going to help. And I do think Mendoza is a generational talent. I don't know if he's going to be able to hit it his rookie year. That'd be my one concern with Patsy. But I think he is absolutely a franchise quarterback. And between him, I was high on Genty going in. I was kind of shocked with his performance this year, but I'll kind of blame that on some of the coaching. I think with how Kubiak was able to scheme Walker and Sharp in Seattle, if he can't do the same thing with Genty, then maybe he really is a bust.
I'm going to agree with you. I think that's the team. Because again, you are talking to the guy who clowned himself by picking the Raiders as a dark horse wild card team this past year. I agree with you.
That's,
I think,
not
the
crazy,
roster,
though.
That roster was better than it ended up looking like. I blame a lot of that on coaching. That roster did not have as many holes, at least at the beginning of the year, as it ended up happening. Then they, you know, when they get into tank mode, you know, and start making trades, then it's a different story. But yeah, I mean, Bowers is tied for your guy McBride as the best tight end in the league. Those guys are generational players at tight end. So you have the co-best tight end in the league for Mendoza coming in. You have Ashton Genty, like you said. I think he is going to have I still think his career is going to be on par with one of the last guys to be super highly drafted at running back, Bijan Robinson. I expect him to have a career that's kind of neck and neck there. So I agree with that. They need to upgrade some at wide receiver, but they will. I think that'll be a focus.
You still have Crosby.
Yeah, you still have Crosby defensively here.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think, again, the Mendoza thing, this will be very, very, very interesting. And again, as I teased out with you last time here, that we will be putting the band back together for another live stream on NFL draft night, night one anyways, this year. I can't wait for what's going to be the back and forth with not just me and FDH senior editor Jason Jones, but maybe a couple other people too, because he's crawling out on that limb of like, I don't know, I think like Mendoza might be maybe a Jared Goff kind of guy. He doesn't really wow me. And like, I'm looking forward to putting the question to him, what can't that guy do? Because at one point in time or another, I've seen him do everything that you'd want, literally everything out of a
franchise. I've never been more sure on a quarterback coming out of the draft. I don't think I've ever gone in and said, I'm 100% sure this guy is going to be good. Maybe I might have been pretty, I was pretty high on Burrow. But no, I think Mendoza, I will actually eat my hat and several other hats. I'm not saying he is going to be like an all-star, like Burrow rookie year and crush it, but he is going to have a great career. And if like, I would put all of it on that. The mental side's too much there in terms of like how he processes the game, how he has just mentality as like an athlete, as a person. He's not going to get in trouble. Seems like a good glue guy in the locker room. And yeah, just in terms of what he can do as a quarterback, I agree. I've seen him do it all.
Yeah. And again, relatively speaking, but mobility for a guy that's 6'5". He's a guy, he is not a liability when it comes to mobility for a guy of his build, which is kind of incredible to say. So yeah, I mean, he can do it all. I look forward to jousting with Jason on that one, as well as any number of other things on draft night, and as well as the pre and post draft coverage that we end up doing, which also I will say too, when you talk about Kubiak, This circles back one last point for me on Seattle is that, again, it looks like they're going to promote from within, stay with the same system. So Sam Darnold is not going to be having to adjust to something different next year. We saw Sam Darnold do all of this in year one in this system, and there may be some tweaks and nuances that are different, but Mike McDonald is a smart enough guy to say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So you have to make an adjustment, and that's that old saying that, if you have to change horses, at least change with a horse that's going in the same direction. And that's what they're going to do. They're going to have continuity in their offensive operations next year. So a lot to look forward to. We are coming off of a year of such crazy chaos, again, with all of the unexpected things that happened this past year. Probably snap back to a greater degree of normalcy in 2026, but what does that look like?
We'll see what happens with the offseason, though. This is going to be a wild offseason after all the coaching changes, the amount of quarterback needs that teams have, and that this is one of the few years that it's no one's going to be looking to do it in the draft. Like, it's going to be a blockbuster trade-filled offseason for sure.
It's going to be, and again, just doing a little bit of the early offseason work here and looking at this, and I'll be releasing this shortly, our FDH pre-free agency needs assessment. It looks like the needs per team is up on average decently from what it was last year. So coming off of such a chaotic season, I guess you would expect that. But it's a thing where I think like the average number of holes per team last year was under 8. And this year it looks like it's approaching 9. So that's... It kind of matches with what we've seen that, there are teams. And again, I think that's one of the big stories of the season and why things played out. You saw that there were holes that popped up that you didn't expect to be there before the season. It's the exact opposite of what I said about Seattle before. And maybe one of the biggest, maybe my misstep on Seattle's roster explains their rise better than just about anything else. In a year where I was wrong, more wrong than I almost ever am about holes on a roster, I thought that they had failed to address a number of holes in the offseason. And they surpassed that expectation by a country mile in a year where I think the rest of the league kind of receded in that. A lot of rosters that looked stable ended up not being as much because of injuries, regression, and other things like that. So in that way, that almost feels like kind of a nutshell summation for the season to me, and something that would mark it as probably being an outlier from 2026 and most other seasons.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other piece to add to it, too, is that people are going to be, I would imagine, owners are going to be a little more open to spending after seeing what Seattle was able to do in 1 year. If you have the right coaching and the owner's willing to spend money, you can do it. And you can go from zero to hero in a year. I hope that kind of encourages, because I feel like we just haven't seen going and, it resulted in like the sort of the chaos and just the kind of separation that we saw where, you know, you had certain teams that were just all stars and then everyone else kind of not, because there, there weren't a lot of major, huge, crazy trades or changes in the off season. There was kind of the normal amount. I think we're going to see a complete shakeup of the league this year with just the amount. Again, I think the amount of quarterback deficiencies right now and the lack thereof of opportunities to fill them in the draft, it's gonna lead to absolute chaos, but in a good way. It's gonna be a complete shakeup.
Well, and that's the whole thing too, that I think, and that's gonna be another focus of one of my rants around draft time here. When I go back to, again, whether it be Browns analysts in the preseason saying, "I refuse to accept this," or people going into the Super Bowl, "I refuse to accept that this is not going to be a legitimate Super Bowl and exciting." That's the same kind of mentality that made Dante Moore number two on all the draft boards out there. Like, this guy desperately needs another year in college. You saw it in the national semifinals.
Yeah.
Quarterbacks that only have had about a year or so of starting have a brutal record in the NFL. I saw Dwayne Haskins, who, that guy looked as can't-miss as anybody could look, and came out, and again, he went to Washington, which was a dumpster fire at the time, but you saw the whole one-year thing manifest itself with him, and yet the league was like, I don't care, he's good enough. So it's like, there's a tendency to do that, right? And that's the whole thing. That's going to make somebody reach on Ty Simpson. Like, I don't care, he's good enough in that spot, we're going to take him. Somebody's going to do that, Derek. I'm calling it now.
I don't know. That's interesting. You think Ty Simpson is going to go in the first round?
Yeah, I think he could go top 10. You forget every year, silly season. How did J.J. McCarthy get to be the 12th pick in the draft? Silly season. This is like, at the time I was like, what the hell is going on here? I thought Minnesota was supposed to be the smart version of the Browns. Analytics done right. And they go for J.J. McCarthy? Like, you get the silly season, and that's where everybody talks themselves into this kind of stuff. And that's where, again, and like a lot of times, people, I think, will sometimes, you know, bristle a little bit, and perhaps in how I express it, but of like my, you know, stern consistency on things here. And it's like, I'm just sitting here when I hear this kind of crap, like, wait a minute. The guy played his last game, what, 2-3 months ago? What makes you think he's any different
now? No one in the top 10 is going to – like, the Jets are obviously the Raiders, but we know what they're doing. The Jets are the only team that needs a quarterback in the top 10.
True.
Everyone else has their guy.
True. Yeah, that is the case.
Tennessee isn't going to move on. New York's obviously happy. Cleveland has more quarterbacks than, you know.
Cleveland could, though. They could or would or whatever.
That would be.
Yeah. Well, you know, all the aunties would be up in a have their tits in a ringer about the whole thing about moving on from Shadur at this point in time. Although I will say, I mean, luck-wise, for my lifetime as a pro football fan, it would be the most Rick Morris thing ever if the Browns end up snagging Malik Willis away from Miami. Everything looks like it's set up for Malik Willis to go to Miami and do good for
Miami. I don't think you guys are good. I saw earlier the coaching staff wants to put Watson back in the lineup.
They're open to it. There's a lot of clickbait about that. And I think the coach, you know, like, it was just like, well, we'll look at it. Like, he didn't express himself as well as, like, I think Monken was the right hire or an inspired one? No, I don't. Because every time the Browns are like, we're right and the rest of the world's wrong, it never goes well. And the Monken hire was a classic example of we're right, the rest of the world's wrong. But I don't think Monken's a dummy, and he'd have to be a dummy to really entertain Watson doing it. Now, that being said, as a guy who first got really embittered on the Browns when they signed him and who sort of defines himself at this point vis-a-vis the Browns as somebody that just wants to watch the world burn, yes, please put him in, preferably for the home opener. You know, I want to see that. Like, have we ever seen the Browns, same franchise, ironically, that had Bottlegate. But have we ever seen a game where there's been like huge amounts of like rotted fruit and vegetables being thrown from the stands? Like, what's the record for this in NFL history? Because it will be surpassed if Deshaun Watson starts a game for the Browns. And Derek, I am here for it. So, but I don't think it's going to happen. I'm not going to be lucky enough to get that.
But are you making a definitive prediction that Ty Simpson or another quarterback outside of Mendoza will get drafted in the top 10?
Ty Simpson, top 10. Somebody's going to be dumb enough. Yes. You heard it here first. Okay. Yes. It happens every year.
The draft night one fun.
But it
made more sense in the other years. They were like, those teams needed quarterbacks. Like, it's not they're still dumb. They still reached, but they at least needed a quarterback. There's no one in the top 10 besides the Jets that absolutely needs a quarterback. And they technically don't either.
Somebody will trade up. Well, the Jets do, but they're not going to take them at 2, but could they trade back in the top 10 and do that? That's actually a move I could see them making. And it's at least it's defensible of like, well, you don't want to take them at 2. I don't want to take them anywhere in the 16th, first round.
If they took them then, that would make sense.
I think it would be a reach at 16, but he's going in the top 10. Think back to names like Jake Plummer. Like, this happens every year. And it's just, you get the draft season, and it's, once again, the the same people that were making
it. As sure as you are, I am equally sure of the opposite.
I think that's very, with all due respect, very ahistorical, because it happens all the time. It happens all the time of like teams talk themselves into it. And like, we saw something on film. We saw something in the personal workouts. You wouldn't believe how impressive this guy was running around in shorts, throwing a ball, you know, without any defensive pressure in his face. Like, it happens every year. That's how, Plummer, McCarthy. I'll even say Nixon, Penix, and I'm kind of a Penix guy, but like, he didn't deserve to go 8. Nix has played better than I expected him to, but he's still been a reach where he was at. And I think Anthony Richardson, I thought at the time it was a thing where teams were just talking themselves into it, that he was a raw guy. And again, I saw a lot of people make the comparison with Dante Moore had he come out. And for the people to think that it was a mistake, how can you look a gift horse in the mouth, all that money? Well, look, especially in today's inflation rate, right? You could be making a lot of money on that first rookie contract, but if it's literally all you got to live on the rest of your life, you know, that's it. You should be playing for the second contract. It's the second
contract. Where's Zach Wilson?
Yeah.
I know he's on someone's roster, but like, I mean, maybe, but I don't know. We're in this era now where a lot of people are getting redemption arcs. Darnold, Mac Jones, like.
Well, you know, in terms of Zach Wilson, I mean, I don't know where he is physically right now in cyberspace. I think he's on an app, a dating app for women over 65. But I don't know where he's at, you know, geographically right now or on a roster or anything like that. So, yeah, Zach Wilson, that's a huge cautionary tale right there. I remember ragging on my good pal from Sportsology, Russ Cohen, at the time about them passing on Justin Fields for him, which the joke's on me. They end up with Fields and he ends up not being impressive anyways. So a lot of interesting unanswered questions for next year. Is Houston going to pick up the option on CJ Stroud? They're kind of in no man's land. I don't know why you would pick up the option on him after the way that he fell apart in the playoffs and even somewhat before that. So they were my preseason pick to win the AFC. And actually, I think they would have, and maybe convincingly, had Stroud even shown a pulse for a good part of the season, because everything was right there for them. But I mean, that's of course the most important position in the game, though. So if you're getting like less than 0 from your starting quarterback, the guy who's supposed to be your franchise quarterback, no less, you're going to have that. So yeah, a lot of questions heading into the off season. A lot of questions going, you know, as far as how next season will unfold, the draft before then, everything else. So at some point along the way in the off season, I hope I am optimistic for catching up on the show with you here and talking some football. But a pleasure to do this with you as always, Derek. Thank you so much for being here for our Super Bowl pre and post coverage this year.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Derek. Appreciate it. And thank you, everybody, for checking out FDH Lounge mini episode 1906.